Welcome to City Club of Eugene's November 2nd program. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, who will speak on election security. This is the ninth program in our 2018-2019 programming year. This event is being live streamed on our Facebook page. You can send questions to the live stream, and the information about where to send those questions if you're watching is at the bottom of the page. I'm Joel Curran, president of City Club. Support for City Club is provided by our sponsors. You can become a member or a sponsor at cityclubofeugene.org. Our diamond sponsor is Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high quality, affordable health care to improve the health of the members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Our Sapphire sponsor is Summit Bank. Summit Bank's support for City Club, which is your local community bank. Independent community bank headquartered in Eugene. Summit serves the business and professionals in Eugene and Springfield and Central Oregon communities. Learn more at sbko.bank. Today we're honored to have Senator Ron Wyden. Senator Wyden has been a United States Senator from Oregon since 1996, having previously represented Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. Since 2000, Senator Wyden has authorized to secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, commonly known as the County Payments Law, has helped the Oregon hardwood industries and from the import of illegally harvested timber products. Wyden serves on the Committee on Finance, Budget, and Intelligence, and Energy and Natural Resources. I particularly appreciate the work he has done on the intelligence community in letting the country know about invasions into our privacy. He is the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee and the ranking Democrat on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Senator Wyden lives in Portland with his wife, Nancy, and their 5 children. Please welcome Senator Ron Wyden.
So good to be home. How's that? Is that a little better? So good to be home. And let me just be clear. Nobody does democracy better than the Eugene City Club. It is great to be with you. So many voters. And I would like to note we've got some future voters, right? We've got a few of you coming on. So we're glad to have them. I was asked to talk for about an hour. I was told you'd really enjoy that. I'm going to just talk for a few minutes because I think we want to have plenty of time for questions. And in particular, you know, 4 days before the election is a good time to kind of reflect on where we are, particularly with respect to the franchise. And my bottom line today is Oregonians should not have to wait forever for the rest of the country to catch up to paper ballots and vote by mail. I've introduced legislation to do just that. I'm going to talk a little bit about it. But it is particularly important right now because there are states without a paper trail. And there are states that use these voting machines. And it wasn't very long ago when the biggest voting machine company in the country, ES&S, sold machines with remote access software. And folks, that's about as dumb as putting our ballots on the street of Moscow. And we've all watched what's going on in Georgia right now, and the conflict apparently between the Republican candidate for governor and doing the right thing. So we care deeply about these issues. I get asked regularly about voting and voting rights at town hall meetings, and I was the first senator entirely elected by mail. And the right to vote is the core of the freedom that the founding fathers had in mind. Elections, to us, have always been sacred, but our response to the gaps in the system have fallen miles and miles short. The 2016 attack was plotted and perpetrated by agents of the Russian government. And it came from the very top. And everybody knows about the successful efforts to spread lies through social media. Court documents that were released a few months ago showed that Russian intelligence officials hacked into computers, stole data, and planted surveillance software. They were basically out there hoovering up voter data of 500,000 Americans. They targeted our election infrastructure and searched for vulnerabilities that might have allowed them to affect the results. And I'm asked all the time to give people a comparison with respect to how this works. And the best comparison I can give you is that dangerous foreign hackers are like burglars knocking on doors. They're out knocking on doors, they're out knocking on windows, they're just looking for vulnerabilities. Is there somebody who left the garage open or some kind of window that's in the back? And they've got every reason to try it again, and I'm not getting into anything classified, but it is not just the Russians. By the way, you may have seen what happened this week. You know, the president said that the Chinese are meddling with the election. So I decided, because I'm on the Intelligence Committee, my older child calls it the so-called Intelligence Committee, I sent a letter to Dan Coats, the head of National Intelligence. Kamala Harris, our terrific new senator from California, may hear a little bit about her next year. And also Martin Heinrich, my young colleague in New Mexico, very fine senator. We said to the director of national intelligence, the president is out there publicly stating the Chinese are meddling in the elections. You're the director of national intelligence. I don't want you to give out anything classified, but do you agree with the president's public comments? A couple days ago, the head of national intelligence sent me a classified response. So, do you think the president was maybe just possibly fudging on the truth? I don't know. We'll have to see. But the bottom line is these dangerous foreign hackers win when Americans lose faith in our democracy. And it is obvious they are not going to quit. And by the way, when the president's own intelligence officials were asked about the threat, they said, their words, not mine, the lights are blinking red. These are the president's intelligence officials. So, you would think that the federal government, working with the states, would have done everything in its power to secure our elections for 2018 and beyond. That isn't even close to what is happening. The voting machines are still easily hacked. There aren't enough paper ballots backing up the votes. Voter data is not properly secured. And to me, you ought to look at attacks on voting as like military attacks on our country. Given the lack of a strong response, it's as if FDR woke up on December 8, 1941 and say, nobody knows where Pearl Harbor is anyway. A few generations before that, everybody said, it's okay, forget the Alamo. The point is, these are national security issues when dangerous foreign hackers and threats try to rob us of our franchise. And my view is that this administration is basically sitting it out. They haven't done enough to protect this sacred democracy of ours. Now, I want to touch on just a few of the key strategies, and then we're going to get to the questions. All of the independent cybersecurity experts say that there are two things you have to do to protect the vote. Oregon has done both of them. One is to have a paper trail for every ballot cast. And the other is to have what are called risk-limiting audits. And the reason they're so important is that they give you a sense of what the threats might be, what kind of things people are tapping on your windows about. And I introduced legislation that has now been supported by a host of our Senate colleagues to do just that. And I did it after the Homeland Security Department finally said in an open intelligence hearing, and we don't have very many open intelligence hearings, and I treat each one kind of like a ruby in my hands. You have to prepare really to use that moment. Some of you may remember I asked James Clapper at one of the open intelligence hearings whether the government collected any type of data at all on millions of Americans. And he looked at me, and he looked at the committee, and he lied to the American people, said, no, we don't. A few months later, a fellow named Snowden said, I was watching that. That was a lie. And we all know what happened. We got a bill passed to rein some of that in. But you know, the fact is, when you have the Homeland Security Secretary saying that paperless voting machines, these are her words, pose a national security concern, and that they're just too easy to hack, and you can't have an easy way to verify the results, that ought to be a wake-up call. And it is not a Democratic wake-up call or a Republican wake-up call, it's a wake-up call. And it's something that ought to concern everybody. And I mentioned the voting machines. Let me tell you something. The days when these voting machine companies and their lobby are above the law are over. They are over, and I am committed to reining these abuses in. They have stonewalled the Congress for too long. They thought they were above the law. There are no minimum standards for them, and it has to end. Period, full stop. Now, with respect to our efforts overall, I think we have to also bring into this debate the question of the politics of disenfranchising people of color. And I look at what is going on in Georgia. I look at what is going on in a number of communities. There are examples where polling places in majority-minority communities have been closed at higher rates. We have seen evidence of intimidation tactics at the polls. Many Americans of color get kicked off voter rolls when their participation in democracy is just inconvenient to those in power. There's one community in Kansas, Dodge City, that literally moved its polling place outside the city limits to make it harder for people to get there on election day. You'd literally need to get out of Dodge to exercise your right to vote. So I'm going to close by way of saying that this, folks, is deeply un-American, unpatriotic stuff. It's wrong to hurt people of color this way, wrong to hurt working Americans, wrong to hurt young people, wrong to hurt Americans with disabilities. And by the way, we know who it helps. It helps the lobbyists and the special interests. And by the way, it's a huge gift to the dark money crowd. Some of you may have seen I've spent a lot of time trying to rein in dark money. You know what happened a couple weeks ago? The Trump people made it easier for dark money, possibly dark money coming from foreign sources, to get into our election system. They relaxed the requirements on those donations being disclosed by the IRS so we would have the tools to run them down. So now the IRS can't get the information, and nobody else is getting it. And I have real reservations about even how the IRS would find them. And you couple that with the Citizens United decision, which basically took the limits off campaign finance in America, and you have a really combustible mix that can do in the rights of a lot of American voters. So, there's a way to get out of these un-American schemes. And that way, everybody know the way? What is it? Vote by mail. What is it? City Club, I can't hear that. What is the way out? All right, now we're talking. So, I think we're probably going to have to do it in two steps. My first step is my bill to have a paper ballot for everybody, paper trail for everyone. And then my second step is going to be for everybody to have a chance in America to vote by mail. Then we get away from the un-American schemes that I've been talking to you about, the un-American schemes that are disenfranchising people of color and young people and so many working Americans that have given the voting machine lobby unbelievable clout over our elections and perpetrated travesties like we're seeing in the state of Georgia. We are lucky in Oregon to have vote by mail. I'm going to do my very best to take what is yet another Oregon first. We love being first. We've been first in a lot of things. But being first in democracy, that's something that's really special. Thank you for having me. You want me to go over there?
Thank you, Senator. The first question today will be by Cheryl Betchart, clerk of Lane County, and the official responsible for conducting elections here. Now, you may know that this is her busy time. So she may not be able to stay for all of the questions, but she'll stay for as long as she can. So, Cheryl, please.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me here to ask a question of Senator Wyden, and it's a great joy to be here. I know that we're excited for this election and the participation of everyone that's been voting, and we're seeing a nice response so far, and expect that to continue through the election. So Oregon, as we know, has been vote by mail for the past 20 years. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary this November, very exciting. We've had a paper ballot process in place where ballots are tabulated on a closed system here in Oregon. We conduct logic and accuracy tests before elections and after the election before clerks certify election results. In addition, after each general election, we complete a statutory hand count of randomly selected races where individuals confirm that specific ballots were tabulated correctly. Oregon is definitely in the forefront of security. Knowing what Oregon officials already do, Senator Wyden, how do you think this proposed legislation will improve or benefit Oregon's existing process without being burdensome to Oregon counties that will have to expend money to change the election system to accommodate a risk-limiting requirement?
The question of the risk-limiting audits is a very good one, Cheryl. Let's give her a round of applause. She's doing a really good job. Part of what we have tried to do, as you know, is there have been federal funds made available to local jurisdictions. And there's some real questions about how it can be used. But for the kind of jurisdiction you're talking about, where they're doing a good job, they'd like to do a little bit more in the risk-limiting audits, we're going to have a big debate about this, but I am going to push to say, hey, look, I can't think of a better way to help a small jurisdiction that's doing the right thing with democracy than giving them a little financial boost from that election commission fund that would help them go to risk-limiting audits. And as you know, many of them would like to do it, and just as you said, they're worried that they don't have the money, and they're worried about mandates and the like. What I've said is that What we ought to do, particularly at the federal level, is give local jurisdictions more tools so that they can move in the right direction, and you guys already have, and I'm going to push as we look to those federal funds in the future to making help for the small jurisdictions for risk-limiting audits a priority at the commission.
Thank you. Okay, we will now take a five-minute break to formulate questions. While you are formulating questions, please formulate them with a one-minute time limit. We're going to, in order to get as many people as possible to be able to ask the senator questions, we're going to strictly enforce the one-minute time limit with an embarrassing bell if you go over. So take your time and formulate the questions. Thank you.
You're listening to KLCC, informing and inspiring listeners for more than a half century. Broadcasting in HD at KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College.
First question, please.
Nancy F. Rose, City Club member. Thank you for being here, Ron. I have a question, and the way Oregon votes, I like, with one exception. And so if you could get Oregonians to change this, maybe some of the other states would too. If we vote, we either have to find a box, which may not be close to where we live. We have some very large empty areas in the state of Oregon where certain ranchers live. I don't think we should have to put a stamp on the ballot envelope. Is there any way you can help us? Thank you.
I'm sure we're going to continue the debate about whether to put a stamp on it. What I can tell you is your basic question of making sure that there is easy access if you want to get your vote in time and the mail won't deliver it. It's critical that you have enough boxes. So let me call on Cheryl, and I'm not putting you on the spot, but sort of. I'm not getting that complaint very often, and are you all the clerks getting that now, that there aren't enough of the boxes? The boxes go up in the last few days, right? Are you guys getting complaints about that?
I know here in Lane County, we have some folks in the Vida area that are having to drive a certain amount of space to get there, 45, it could be 40 miles if you're upriver. So we're working with those subsets to see if we can facilitate adding another drop box. It's something that we're doing, but of course, there's a cost associated with that. But ongoing for Lane County, we're seeing over 70% of our ballots come back at our drop site locations, which tells us that it is working. Are we meeting all needs for everybody? We certainly probably have room for improvement with various things.
Nancy, thanks for bringing it up. I'm going to follow it up. And, you know, part of this, again, is the Trump people wanted to have it both ways. They really didn't want to do anything for election security. And then they said, well, we'll support this, you know, commission, and they'll hand out cash. You and I think that the kind of thing they ought to be doing is trying to empower people in communities of color and places where it's almost like voting deserts, because you've heard of food deserts, but they're voting deserts where it's hard to access the ballot box. So I'm going to work with the clerks and follow up. Thank you for bringing it up. Nancy Rose, a great activist. Big round of applause. Every good cause in Lane County has the Rose name on it.
Hi, Senator Wyden. Thank you for coming. Becky Gladstone, longtime City Club member. I have two quick questions that are easy, probably not with easy answers. The first one, of course, in the context of League of Women Voters, we really care about the PAVE Act and paper ballots, vote by mail. But I'm interested in knowing what can be done, what you're doing, if there's any hope for Georgia, North Dakota, Dodge. And my second question has to do with Citizens United. Is there any fix for Citizens United other than a constitutional amendment? Thank you.
Questions, two good questions. And let's give a big shout out to the League of Women Voters, too. They do great work. And we were all together. Where's Mr. Richardson and the NAACP? A big shout out for them. Doing a great
job. Vice President
of
City Club.
We were all there at their headquarters, and the League of Women Voters and many groups, they have formally endorsed my legislation, the PAVE Act, to promote both of those two requirements, the paper ballots and the risk-limiting audits. And here's the thing. I'm hopeful that we can get some Republicans when the Senate comes back for the post-election debates, because I think they're going to see they've had some problems in their own systems, and some of them are from states that are kind of moving in our direction to paper ballots. So that's number one. Citizens United. My sense is this court is basically saying now that the rich guy's checkbook is the same thing as the poor person shouting on the street corner. And it's all First Amendment speech, and it's all protected. My own sense is that there would be remedies, but I think with this court, we're going to need a constitutional amendment. But my sense also is the combination of dark, you know, money and some of the new people that are on the ballot this time, we may be able to muster up, you know, the votes. I mean, this is driving all the other decisions. People ask me, what do you need to do to control health care costs? I list two or three things. What do you need to do to get more real renewable energy? I list the things. What do you need to do to have housing priorities that favor the working class rather than the people top? I list the things. Behind every one of them for the status quo is Citizens United. Citizens United is standing right there protecting all those powerful interests. I am committed, and the Oregon Congressional Delegation has several very strong advocates to getting an opportunity for what we're doing here today to be the way we make decisions rather than the Citizens United system that's driven by money.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Senator. My name is Corey Abramson. I'm with Palo Alto Software. And before I start, just wanted to thank you for keeping the internet free and open. Assuming that your Democratic colleagues take the House on Tuesday and have the ability to hold the current administration to task for action and inaction around election security and otherwise, how do you plan to work with Senate Republicans to stray from Senator McConnell's partisanship? How do we get accountability?
The question was about the Senate Republicans. And you know, look, we managed in the last session of Congress to do some really important things. I mean, I got Orrin Hatch, a very conservative Republican, to join me in a 10-year reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program. Mm-hmm. That's something to help millions of kids. Well, it didn't hurt that I told Chairman Hatch that, hey, this is something when you're retiring, kind of a really good thing to go out on. And by the way, Children's Health Insurance Plan is a lot cheaper than a lot of this other stuff that you guys are considering. And he looked at it and he said, yes. So there are some ways in which you can approach it. But those people that you're talking about, the Senate Republicans, up to now, we'll see if this election changes it, have said when the president tweets something or says something like he did after Charlottesville, which I can't even put into words how abhorrent that was. And for the president to say there were two sides to that argument, I mean, they were talking about blood and soil. Folks, that's right out of the Nazi playbook.
Thank you for saying that.
So, those Republicans would say they didn't agree with the president, but they wouldn't ever really oppose him. I think if we have a mandate in this election, and that's why it's so important, we got to get everybody to vote. And if you have friends in other parts of the country, you need to do the same thing. Because this president, he's kind of tried to have it both ways. For a while, he was saying, well, this election isn't about me, because he thought he was going to lose the House. And then he said, it is about me, I'm on the ballot, because he knew that he made it about him. He couldn't kind of get out of it. So I think it is really important that the next 4 days be about showing the country where we stand. And if we do, in the United States Senate, the United States House of Representatives, we'll start seeing some of those Republicans who have said, gee, I didn't agree with what he said in his tweet, say, that's not enough. I'm going to support policies. For example, like protecting Bob Mueller and letting him do his work so we complete that investigation.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Mary Layton. I'm asking a member of City Club asking for a guest. Our guest was very concerned because apparently our two international election observers, Artem Taroff of the United Russia Party and Alexei Konyenko of the Russian Communist Party, are here to certify our elections. The last couple of elections they certified were apparently bogus in Eastern Europe. And she just wondered, is there something to be done about this, or how do you frame that?
European elections?
No, about their coming to certify our elections. Do we care?
My understanding is that's a voluntary program. Where are your guests? Are they here?
The guest was here.
Okay. My understanding is that they're voluntary programs, and they are designed to promote goodwill, and perhaps, and I want to say this diplomatically, you all can go back and suggest to Mr. Putin's staff that maybe they might want to do some voting kind of the Oregon way. Yeah. He's kind of set it up that way, right? So I think the point really is, when we're talking about democracy breaking out around the world, I always start, where do our young people go? They had to go back to class? Okay. I mean, there you are. This is it. This is the face around the world of the changes, and you were talking about Georgia and Turkey and the like, that is going to make things different. And one of the areas I've sort of specialized in is technology. I came to the Senate, and the only person who knew, there was only one senator who knew how to use a computer. And in fact, the late night TV hosts were making fun of the Senate because one of the leading senators was asked what the internet was, and he said it's a series of tubes. And so I have really focused on technology policy. I think the young people know about our fight to promote net neutrality so everybody gets treated fairly on the internet. And just yesterday, I proposed the toughest privacy bill ever introduced, which would include fines for top executives at the technology companies when they lied on their privacy statements. So my hope is that the young people around the world, particularly because there's an opportunity to be more connected through social media, will be part of a grassroots-inspired movement for change. Virtually everywhere, political change never starts at the top and trickles down. It's almost always bottom up rather than trickle down. And that is true virtually everywhere. And you want to have my opinion? And I'm doing what we call listening to the future meetings, you know, where we go out to high schools and just take questions from high school students. I think these young people and their cohort, all the other young people around the world who come to sessions like this, these are our hope, and maybe you can start figuring out a way when you go home to make some connections to them. Great question.
Next, please.
John Attic, City Club member. Consider this question to be one from one former Palo Alto resident to another. Regarding voting machines, I grew up in the Chicago area. One of the motives on Election Day was vote early and vote often. And voting machines at that time, as I recall, were intended to eliminate this kind of practice, you know, which It was quite, I personally knew a couple of very enthusiastic citizens who voted often on election day. And what has happened to voting machines, in your opinion, that has made them a means of fooling with the results of American elections?
Well, I think, as we're seeing with so much of technology, for example, I don't care how much technology we have, we still need something that the founding fathers thought was important, which is direct face-to-face contact. There is no substitute, in my view, for an elected official. I'm now on my, I think, 911th town meeting. There is no substitute. I don't care how much technology we have for citizens to be able to look an elected official in the eye, say, here's my question. Could I respectfully have, you know, an answer? So I consider that in sort of the same vein as your comment about the voting machines. The voting machine that has an actual paper trail that can be validated, that's the kind of thing that, while not as good as vote by mail, at least provides some measure of support to the citizenry. But that's not what the powerful voting machine lobby wants. The voting machine lobby, as far as I can tell, has said, look, let's just figure out how to dominate the political system, and we're going to make a lot of money, and if we cut some corners, that's the way it is. They want to be the safeguard of our democracy, but they won't do any safeguarding. So to me, what's really changed from your Chicago days is, of course, with software and algorithms and the like, it's so much easier to exploit those systems if you're a dangerous foreign hacker. And what's happened is, instead of recognizing kind of when you have technology, you still need to factor in humans, they wouldn't go forward with the paper trail, so we'd have some accountability.
I forget which Chicago politician said it, but they said they wanted to die and be buried in Chicago so they could continue to be involved in politics. Jack?
Okay, yeah. I'm Jack Dresser. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, among other things. You know, former NSA World Technical Director Bill Binney and Ray McGovern, former head of the CIA Russia desk for 10 years, have explained that the timestamps on the DNC data file obtained by WikiLeaks show a data transmission speed far greater than possible over the internet. The speed, in fact, of a direct download to a thumb drive. The DNC server, which the FBI was not permitted to examine, was therefore not hacked by Russia. So how can you trust these newer claims about social media efforts at manipulation supposedly orchestrated from St. Petersburg?
Well, I think, take a look at this morning's newspaper. This morning's newspaper has a long email chain of how top people in the Trump campaign, where did my questioner go? Is he floating around somewhere? Oh, great. The email chain that's in the paper today involves Steve Bannon, Roger Stone, and WikiLeaks. And all they're talking about is how to rip off the American political system. Now, being on the Intelligence Committee, I'm not going to get into that, but let me put it this way, and I'm choosing my words carefully. If Steve Bannon and Roger Stone and WikiLeaks coordinated their communications and tried to infiltrate the American political system, there is a wide variety of criminal and civil violations that have been perpetrated. For example, it's a crime to be involved in helping foreigners undermine our electoral system. So I think I'm going to leave it at that. I mean, there were so many signals. I mean, the widely reported meeting that Donald Trump Jr. went to. I mean, his email showed an intent to collude. His own email. Bob Mueller has been indicting people and getting guilty pleas right and left. And he's a do-it-by-the-book prosecutor. So I think there's a lot of hard evidence there.
John?
John DeLoe, City Club member, and I have a question here for what happens if an error is found or discovered after a risk-limiting audit? Does that change the outcome of an election?
Cheryl, I don't think you change outcomes of elections like that, but is there any Oregon law on that point? Right. But the way I interpreted the question, and it's a very much more thoughtful answer, is if one ballot was found to be in error, you don't go out and have a whole new election. Yeah. But if you had a number of them, then it raises questions about how to proceed. Okay. Is that marginally understandable? Okay.
Apparently, recount.
No. I think Cheryl's whispering in my ear. No, you don't have to have a new election.
Hi, Kara Smith, Food for Lane County, and a City Club member, and thank you for being here. And I'm here to ask a question on behalf of one of our guests, Aviv Bernstein Livney.
You guys like the Senate? You yield to each other?
I can't talk because I'm not a member.
But you can be. You can join.
But they're here with the Young Democrats of Lane County. And the question is, what would it...
All the young people right there? Great. Give them a round of applause for showing up. And more. Okay. All right. I'm glad we gave them their second round of applause. Good.
The question is, what would it take to end child marriage in the United States?
Child marriage.
Can I? Or marriage to, I guess, minors.
Yeah.
Children under the age of 18.
Go ahead.
So in the United States, currently in 48 states, it's legal for minors to marry.
Right.
A lot of times you need consent of the parent.
And
but
it's
usually,
under state law.
Yeah.
Right.
But would it be possible to get some sort of federal mandate that outlaws it? Because there's been children as young as 11 that have been married here in the United States. And in Florida, every couple of days a minor is married. So clearly we need to do something about it.
Yeah, your point is... is a very good one, and I think I'd be reluctant to say, because what we're always trying to do is not have the federal government just come in and say, hey, state law is irrelevant. I'd probably rather try to target federal abuses as I have, for example, because I think a lot of those young people you're talking about end up being victims of sex trafficking. And so I've been very involved in beefing up the penalties for those who traffic children. I think it's one of the most immoral, outrageous offenses imaginable. And the traffickers really prey on the most vulnerable kids. So let's take your example. Say you have a young person in a foster care facility. You know what happens when a kid runs away in a wealthy neighborhood? The whole town is out there looking for that kid in a wealthy neighborhood. Kid runs away in a foster care facility. They may not know about it for days, and nobody's out there looking for it. So I wrote a law that said that not only will there have to be an effort to check for the child, but if the child is, in effect, kidnapped, taken away by sex traffickers, there are much more serious penalties for those kind of offenses. So let me think about it. But from the seat of my pants, I probably would have some reservations about the federal government just replacing every state law in this area. Family law has been one that's tried to give the states a pretty wide berth. But your point is a valid one because you're trying to focus on abuse of children. And there is no question that there is abuse, and I'd start with building up our efforts on sex trafficking.
Would it be at least possible to make it so children can divorce without the consent of the parents, given that it's usually the parents that force the children into the marriages in the first place?
Another very good question. The big question here, and I'm willing to talk to you all some more about it, is at a time when, especially in Oregon, we like having the freedom to do our own thing in a variety of areas, and we think we've been smarter and more creative. We were the first to do death with dignity. I have real reservations about just sweeping in and the federal government saying we're going to set the standards all across the country. I share your view that the federal government ought to be doing more about abuse, and there's no question that the young people you're talking about are very vulnerable. I have some questions about whether we ought to just have a one-size-fits-all federal law. Good on you. Great question. Give them a round of applause. Very good.
Can Congress end the poverty of 50 million Americans and end homelessness on all our streets? I'm old enough that I've known decades with no homelessness. Not a single person abandoned the way it's going now.
I am so glad you're talking about it, because I want everybody to know in the next Congress, one of my top priorities is going to be for the federal government to step up and deal with this homeless problem. I mean, what we're seeing all over Oregon and all over the country is increased homelessness. And this is a moral blot on our state and nation. To have all these veterans on the streets homeless after they've served the country, you know, maybe they have PTSD, maybe they've got a variety of health issues. What's been the response of the Trump administration? They want to cut Medicaid, and a big chunk of the people on the streets need Medicaid. And I want you to know that as long as I am the senior Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, which has jurisdiction over Medicaid, if they try to take away funding for mental health services and other folks who are on the streets, they're going to have to run over me to do it. And I'm telling you, we've got to come together and win that fight. That's what Oregon's all about. And it is not just Medicaid. We need to improve low-income housing. So I'm the sponsor of the low-income housing tax credit. And we've got to do it in a different way. One of the concerns I'm hearing from folks on the street is sometimes, even when it's cold and raining, it's horrible, there's a sense of community on the street. And they say, I don't want to go into a big high-rise building where there's no sense of community. And so what I've been involved in is trying to tailor some of the housing for the homeless so that there is kind of a communal eating area and a community socializing area and the like. So Medicaid, housing, and then finally, with respect to jobs, we've now got this bizarre situation. I can't even recall a time like this, where we have all these employers who have jobs and say they can't find workers. And then we got all these folks who are out of work, and they're saying they can't find a job. And there's just a big disconnect. And a lot of it involves how vulnerable groups, like the homeless, haven't had the opportunity to get the services that let them get back on their feet and the like. And I'm going to be introducing legislation to connect those two groups. Employers who say they need workers, and folks, whether it be homeless people or minorities or people who lost their jobs after 20 years and are seeking training, we need to make a connection there. And that's something that's going to be a priority of mine for the next session of Congress. Where's the person who asked about the homeless? Where's that gentleman?
Jerry. Jerry's around here somewhere.
Where is
he? Here he is, right there.
Great. Thank you very much. And this is going to be a priority of mine.
What's gone is welfare or a safety net. Social Security, it's supposed to help disabled people, is holding people's applications for 2 years. They don't apply until in 2016, 7,400 of them received their benefits after they were dead. It doesn't do any good to do that kind of thing. Why don't we love people? What's wrong with welfare? Why don't we have it anymore?
Thank you.
What I want to answer is his point, though. We were able to get a bit of money to reduce the Social Security backlog, but it is still light years behind. So there's a lot more to do. But I do need to tell you what the biggest threat is, and you may have seen a little bit about. About a week or so ago, Mitch McConnell went on a whistle-stop tour. And the federal deficit, of course, has grown dramatically because of the tax bill. So when you hear a story like that, the logical thing is to say, hey, we might have to roll back a little bit some of those benefits for people at the top. You know, the top, you know, earners, let's just roll them back. And that would be a good way to start reducing the deficit. What Mitch McConnell did relates to this gentleman's good question. Mitch McConnell said the first thing they would do in terms of the deficit, if Republicans controlled all the branches of government, they would put Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid on the chopping block. So you think we got challenges today? Let me tell you, the gentleman's point is a good one. But we opened the insurance exchange for open enrollment yesterday. And I pointed out that despite the Trump efforts to unravel those benefits, like they want to sell junk insurance and all the rest, as of now, those health care benefits, the tax credits and the like, they are all still on the books. If Mitch McConnell has his way, the gentleman who correctly says we ought to be doing more to help the people on Social Security and cut the backlog more and the like, that's not going to be the question. Mitch McConnell is going to say, my response to the deficit is to put Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid on the chopping block, and it'll be my job to keep him from being able to do it.
Tanif has walked away from these children. These children, they're too shy to come up and speak.
But I'm going to introduce you.
Thank you. But there are 2,000 to 4,000 children homeless on our streets.
Thank you,
children.
Jerry.
We used to have AFDC. Everybody thinks there's welfare. That's horseshit. There's been no welfare
for years. Senator, can I move back to voting for just a second?
Sure.
It's my understanding that your bill is based on federal jurisdiction over federal elections. Correct?
Right.
What can the Congress do to, in that jurisdiction or with that jurisdiction, to stop the voter suppression, to stop moving election places to vote out of Dodge? What can Congress do?
There, of course, is the Voting Rights Act, which is the central piece of legislation, but this Supreme Court has weakened it. So that is why we are trying to find as many aggressive clerks and local officials as we possibly can. But the Voting Rights Act is the principal tool at the federal level to stop voting suppression if, for example, it's being done on the basis of race or something of that nature.
Okay. Thank you.
Ruth Demler, member, and I have two young students who are our special guests today. They would like to ask some questions.
Good.
Hello, Senator. My name's Connor, and I'm the chair of the Young Democrats of Wayne County. And I was just wanting to ask you, what can we do to better include young people in politics?
Question was about young people in politics. Well, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm having a big chunk of my town hall meetings. I go to every county every year. Like last week, I went to Eastern Oregon, and I think almost all of them I had at a high school. And we split the questions between the high school students and the adults in the audience. So that, I don't know very many senators who are doing it, but I'm going to sure try to get more to do that. We call them listening to the future sessions. What high school are you at?
All of us here are from South right now.
Well, why don't I come to South for a listening to the future?
Let's do
All right, you got a lot of witnesses. I'll be there.
Folks, we still have time for a few more questions.
A lot,
if you
of,
want to get,
a lot of witnesses
get up there.
Heard me say, I'll be at his high school. Number one. Number two, I hope some of you, usually it's towards the end of high school, early college, will like to be interns in our office. We always have, there we go, we got an intern right there. I got a lot of witnesses for all these promises I'm making. Okay.
Hi, my name is Emma, and I'm a member of Young Dems, best friend to the chair. And my question is, how can conversations about politics be included into the school curriculums as a requirement?
Question was, how can politics be introduced into the school curriculum as a requirement? You know what's striking? Because I just went through it. I had 5 town meetings in high schools, and what I decided about 910 town meetings ago, that my official meetings would not be primarily about politics. In other words, if somebody asked me, who are you for county commissioner, or county this, or county that, I'd say, look, I'm an Oregonian. I'll be glad to talk to you about that in the parking lot. But the reality is, all of the issues we're talking about here today, when you're talking about protecting the franchise, that's politics. And what I have tried to do is say, here's where we need to go, here's what we need to do, without explicitly going to the point where you should vote for so-and-so. But it's a very good question you're asking, and I think there is a way to talk about policy and substance and give both sides an opportunity to be heard where it can be done. And I know of no prohibition on a school doing that. I mean, maybe there's some school board somewhere that said, no, no, no. But, I mean, talking about policy, being fair to both sides, I like to think, and that's why I do my listening to the future things, and you'll see, when I'm at South, we'll be talking about policy. I'll ask young people, what do you think ought to be done about holding down the costs of college? What do you guys think ought to be done about climate change? What do you think ought to be done about protecting a woman's right to choose? So I'll be talking about policy. But I won't say, hey, I need you to go vote for so-and-so. Get my point?
Thank you, everybody. That concludes the question period.
Oh,
we've run out of
don't
time.
I have
I'm
a question.
Sorry, Ruth.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. First, I'd like to congratulate all the members of City Club for managing to ask questions in under a minute. This may be a new world record. Senator, just a second so I can conclude. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you. I said at the beginning, whatever it was, an hour and a half ago, this City Club is democracy at its best. There was not a bad question in the House. To have all these young people here talking about how more young people can get involved in politics is at the top of my agenda for Oregon. And so I'm walking out of here, as always, as a duck, I would point out, really being proud of our community. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. We may have to change our mission statement to democracy in action. On December 14th, we'll be having our Gifts to the City program, and are asking you, the members, you wanted to do that, didn't you? To begin thinking about who should be gifters, please let us know by going to the website under the suggest a program and list the folks. Thank you, folks. Excuse me. Next week, the program will be our Children's Trust. It was supposed to be a report from the trial, but it'll be a report about what their goals are and what their theories are. So come back next week to hear Professor Mary Christina Wood, John Davidson, Coriel Ridley White of our Children's Trust, and Kelsey Juliana. More details, cityclubofeugene.org. I'd like to thank Senator Wyden.